aliens to flying saucers.
This is all an illusion. Please pardon the confusion.
Hey, Hakuna Matata. That means no worries for the rest of your days. And welcome to the 13th episode of Two Riders Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, author of multiple New York Times bestsellers, and a columnist for The Athletic. The music you're listening to is Croissant's Master by the one-of-a-kind MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from journalism to songwriting to screenwriting to novels to romance to whatever you think of, I'm going to try to handle. And today's guest is Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Jervis of USA Today, who, as a guy based out of Texas, covers weather, bad weather, awful weather. As 99% of humanity runs away, he's charging the storm. So this week, appropriately, we'll talk about Hurricanes Harvey and Irma and how outlets go about their reporting. Rick is also USA Today's former Baghdad bureau chief, who participated in more than 20 military embeds. He also covered the trial, conviction, and execution of Saddam Hussein. So today, our break from fun and games and sports. Let's get a bit serious here on Two Riders Slinging Yang. I didn't mention this in the intro, but you and I actually met back in the summer of 1993 when we interned together at the Nashville Tennessean. We lived in the non-air-conditioned dorms of Tennessee State University. You had a roommate who was a photographer from the Miami Herald who had a girlfriend nicknamed Rabbit. I had my roommate was a rapper from Oakland nicknamed Sexy Sweat. Mm-hmm. All the people involved were good. And you were actually my savior at one of the lowest moments of my life, which is a bar called Ace of Clubs where, you know, I was just a lightweight from the University of Delaware and I probably drank too much. And I remember vividly dancing with a girl from the University of Michigan about to make my move. And the next thing I know, I think it's the next morning and you're telling me that I passed out in a bar.
I can't remember that. I can't actually believe that you remember the name of the bar. That is so impressive.
Thank you.
The Ace. What was it?
The Ace of Clubs. Ace of Clubs.
The Ace of Clubs. Wow. Yeah. All I remember about that night, and I basically knew at the time that you weren't a drinker, that like you didn't drink. You almost never drank, I guess.
Yep.
And I remember kind of egging you on and making you have like a couple of cocktails. I think we had like two rum and cokes or something. And I was like, come on, just kind of have a sip. And you drank them. And I was like, I was off in the corner of the bar, either dancing with somebody or about to buy another drink. And I hear over the loudspeakers, Rick Jervis, Rick Jervis. If there's a Rick Jervis in here, please come to the front of the club. And the bouncer is there and you're pointing to you and you're on the floor. And I'm like, wait a minute, how did this happen? We went from 60 to zero in like a couple of seconds. And you were just totally like out of it. And I just kind of, I kind of knew that it just kind of hit you the wrong way. And I was like, felt terrible. Cause you know, I basically was the one buying you the drinks. And I remember, I sort of remember telling the actual bouncer, I'm like, oh, he had some bad shrimp earlier. And he just like hit him wrong. And just picking you, kind of scooping you up, and I had to like drag you out of this club. And that's how I first met Jeff Perlman. That was my best Jeff Perlman moment of the summer.
And that began my battle with alcoholism. And I've been drinking.
And you've continued ever since.
Exactly.
You've had many blackout nights.
Many.
I don't believe that for a minute.
Well, you know, it's funny when we I was telling my wife about this the other day. When I interned at the paper at the Tennessee, so I feel like every college journalism program pumps out a few quote unquote stars, not stars, but guys who definitely want to go into the field and they love journalism and maybe they're a little ahead of the game because they read newspapers and they study. And I remember getting to the Tennessean and here's this guy, Rick Jervis, and he has his clip folder. I think you had either a clip folder or you had the article hanging up, but you'd done a story where you went undercover as a homeless guy.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, I'm being serious. I remember being like, damn, this guy is really good. Because usually at your college paper, it's almost like a good college football player going to an NFL training camp. And all of a sudden you're like, whoa,
there's a lot of talent here. And I think seeing you and your work was the first time I was like, whoa, I'm not as good as I think I am. There are a lot of good people out here, you know?
Wow, I totally forgot about that article. Yeah, and those are the types of articles that you could write, like, in college. They're kind of sort of experimental that you would never write later, right?
No.
Like, you would never dress up as a homeless person and walk around downtown Miami and, like, write that article as like, a first person. It's just something that I did for the college because I was just really curious, you know, about the all the homeless people, like, in downtown Miami and who they were and what they did. And that was one of the stories, that just like, you know, I kind of showed that to like sort of recruiters and editors at like different newspapers, and everybody liked it quite a bit, even though it was this weird, you know, it was this weird story where I went undercover and wrote it in like first person. I think I was walking around like at the Tennessean with this sort of portfolio of like a couple of my articles, and that was actually one of them. And I kind of let you look at it, look through it, and I remember us having a sort of rivalry, like at the Tennessean, like we definitely wanted to write a better story than like the other guy constantly, and we're trying to constantly like sort of better ourselves. But you know, I think it like made us better, and I think it gave us like a really good internship that summer.
Oh yeah, that was a great summer. It's one of the best summers of my life, actually, and I look back very fondly
for like a lot of different reasons. You know, it wasn't just the internship. Obviously, we had like a really great time outside of the newsroom too.
Yeah, it was really good. And also, I think you know, I wonder if you feel this way. Actually, I do wonder how you feel about this. That's 24 years ago. And you and I both, I'm sure we both had similar sort of goals. You work there, you intern, you graduate, you go on to a big newspaper, then you make it to a bigger newspaper, you become kind of a journalism star, blah, 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 blah. And I wonder, has it lived up to the billing? Like for you, here we are 24 years removed. Is journalism what you've wanted it to be?
You know, that's a really good question. And like every time that I think that it's not, it turns around and really surprises me and slings me in like another direction. And shows me that it just really is like one of the best professions out there. So I think the answer to that question has to be, I mean, it has to be yes for me, right? It has to be yes, because it has taken me to so many different places, showed me so many different things, showed me so many different corners of the world, places that I would never go if I like wasn't in journalism. It's allowed me to do things. It's allowed me to keep writing, you know, which is one of my deepest loves in life, and it has shown me this really colorful, interesting, like 2.5-decade career that I just like can't imagine a lot of other jobs which would like give me that, you know. So I mean, it's not a perfect profession. There are ups and downs, just like everything else, and there are times that, especially recently, when it's like going through some of its sort of like convulsions and like trying to reinvent itself, and you know, journalism in the sort of digital age is a whole nother animal. And there are days where you rethink it, and you kind of wonder if you're in the right profession. But just consistently, it's like really showed me like so much good and so much adventure that it has to be a yes.
Right. You could have spent the last 24 years like drilling teeth. You know, that doesn't sound as good.
Yeah. Yeah. Counting papers, being an accountant, or nothing against accountants.
Right.
Accountants are very valuable, but
right. Yeah.
It's just I could have been doing a lot of different things.
Right. So I'm fascinated by, you know, obviously this week, last week, the week before, the hurricanes have been in the news. You're based out of Austin. You are, mm-hmm. among other tricks, sort of in your hat, is you cover weather, you know, in that region. Like, you are a guy who covers weather.
Correct.
And I wonder, so what is it to cover a hurricane? I mean, almost soup to nuts. Like, here you are in Austin. We know Hurricane Harvey is coming. We know it's coming to Houston. How does it work for you?
The thing about Harvey really blindsided me and blindsided like a lot of people, because, first of all, I haven't covered a major hurricane in quite some time. And that's, I think in part because there really haven't been major hurricanes, you know, a lot of major hurricanes, like hit the U.S. They're actually fairly rare, right? Like a Cat 3 or 4 or 5 hurricane to like hit the U.S. So Harvey started off as a tropical disturbance down in the Gulf. And I was monitoring it kind of because, you know, those actually pop up all the time and they just kind of go away or they just kind of slide into Mexico as a tropical storm or a Cat 1 and nothing comes out of it. And then it pops up in the Gulf and I was monitoring it. And then when it became a tropical storm and started heading towards the Texas coast, that's when we got interested in it. But I remember talking to my editor about it and we basically decided on Thursday, so it basically made landfall on Friday night, and we decided Thursday morning that I should head down to Corpus because it was a tropical storm at that point, and it was it might have been a Category 1 hurricane already. But I drive down to Corpus thinking that I'm covering a Category 1, possibly Category 2 storm, which is nasty, but it's not a monster. And it just intensified so quickly. Like over the course of a couple of hours, it went from a Cat 2 to a projected Cat 4 making landfall, like over the course of the same day, which you never see. So I was driving down to Corpus Christi from Austin, which is a 3.5 hour drive with just, you know, I had just packed like, you know, a couple extra t-shirts, my sort of hiking shoes in case I had to go into sort of debris filled areas, and my toiletries and not much else, you know, like a raincoat, obviously. Mm-hmm. Thinking that this is going to be a minor storm, and I had no idea that it was going to evolve into this really monstrous storm. And so I made landfall as a Category 4. So basically what I was trying to do was try to get down close enough to where the eye was actually sort of projected to land, but not too close. And I'm right in the middle of it and getting all the really nasty eye wall stuff. That's what like storm chasers do. And those guys I have total sort of respect for all those guys who like go into the middle of the storm. But I try to get close enough so that I'm sort of positioned that I could go cover it safely, but not be right in the middle of it. And so Corpus seemed like a pretty good spot. Although, you know, at that point, it was kind of projected to like go over Corpus too. It was kind of wiggling back and forth between Rockport, which is 30 miles north, and Corpus Christi. So basically what I try to do is try to go down to Corpus. I was right on the coast. You try to find a very sturdy building, you know, like
right.
you want to find something that hopefully, which was built relatively recently and it's up to code, or something that is just that, you know, it's kind of concrete poured and looks like it could withstand certain winds. And I found that in the Holiday Inn, right in downtown Corpus Christi, it looked big enough. They gave me a room with a view to the actual bay there, which I wasn't crazy about at first, but later it actually proved pretty good because I could like monitor the actual storm coming in. And so you try to get as close as you can. You basically interview as many people like as you can as the storm approaches. And then it's kind of a race against time. Like you try to get as much as you can. And when the winds pick up, you basically have to know when to like go indoors and take shelter and kind of hunker down and then let the sort of hurricane pass over you. And once it passes, then the sort of trick is to like try to get out to some of the impacted areas just as fast as you can, but as safely as you can. So like you don't want to do it like while there's still a Category 1 wind outside. You want to do it when it kind of dies down and it's fairly safe to like do it.
Is it scary?
This one was, for sure. This one was one of the more frightening stories that I've actually covered in quite a long time. It was scary, and you know, again, part of it is that I'm not used to covering major hurricanes. You know, this is not something I've covered a few in the past. Sorry, I got a plane flying overhead.
Right.
But I've covered a couple of hurricanes when I was back in New Orleans. I covered Isaac, which like came, Gustav. I kind of missed us and went to like Houston, but And back when I was at the Miami Herald, covered a couple of storms, but this one was about as close as I've ever been to landfall of a major hurricane. You know, Harvey was a category. I'm pretty sure, I have to think back. I'm pretty sure it was a category 4 when it made landfall. It might have been a strong 3, but it was like right around there. And we were on the south side of the storm, so we were getting maybe category 2 gusts, like category 1, category 2 gusts. So we were on the weaker side of the storm, and it still felt like the world was ending outside. I mean, it was like just gusts pounding my window. There was like, it creates these like strange popping noises, like right outside your window, like loud bangs. And just having it pass over you was like kind of frightening. I just thought, you know, I hope a window doesn't burst. If it does, I have to go downstairs and find another room. I was pretty sure that my building was actually secure enough that it wasn't just going to like implode or the roof was going to fly off. But it is scary. And, you know, the scarier part is like afterwards, you know, Saturday morning, me and a couple of colleagues got in our cars and like drove to some of the really impacted areas like Fulton and Rockport. And Rockport just got demolished, just flattened. And we get there right around dusk. Dawn. We get there so we basically left at night, and we get there just as the sun rising, and we got the first glimpse of all this really bad destruction and people just coming out of their shelters and homes in shock. They're in total shock, you know, and you're just dealing with these folks who are in shock, trying to get their stories down, but just trying to help them too as much as possible. And it's a really weird place, like to be so close to people who have gone through such a traumatic experience, you know, like you're witnessing trauma firsthand. And it's really, I mean, that part's also like frightening, just kind of witnessing and talking to these people about what they've also been through. Some of these people like came out of motels, which like fell on top of them.
Right.
And it crawled out of rubble. And it's just pretty amazing to like hear some of those stories.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel like, because I ask myself this a lot in journalism over the years, a million times, I'm sure you have too. When you're interviewing someone who just lost everything or is just seeing that their house has been destroyed, someone who's going through trauma, through shock, do you ask yourself, is this what I'm doing right? Am I doing the right thing by doing this? Am I here? Am I approaching this rightly? Is this even moral what I'm doing? Is getting the story more important than letting them grieve? Do you know all the sort of things that kind of must be there at that moment?
I mean, these are things that I ask myself, Jeff, all the time, obviously, of course. And like basically what you try to do is try to approach it as sensitively as possible. I think that I'm fortunate that I've had a long kind of career in this, and I've done this quite a bit, you know. So I've actually spoken to people who are just emerging from some of the worst moments in their lives, whether it's, you know, they've had a loved one murdered, or they've come out of a tornado, or they've coming out of something like this. And yeah, I'm constantly balancing, you know, try to be sensitive to their situation with, you know, try to do your job and try to report to the world what's like really happening. And the thing that I've found over and over again is that, and I'm pretty constantly surprised by this. Like I never truly expect people to like talk to me. And I'm always surprised by how often people want to talk to me. Like it's almost therapeutic for them sometimes, right? You know? And sometimes they just start talking and they just can't stop, and they want to, it's part of their process too, to like unload it all and unpack it all and just kind of tell you about it. And they start talking about these horrific circumstances that they've just been through.
Right.
And sometimes they like end up thanking you, and they end up hugging you sometimes, you know. I feel sometimes, and you know, with this last one, especially out of Rockport, when you see some of these people who have just been through this, and some of the firefighters too, like I talked to like a group of firefighters from Rockport who basically had to evacuate out of their station because it was like breaking apart on them, and they had to run to this elementary school down the road, And they were in shock. They were, and these are like these burly, big firefighters who have gone through, who have gone through this stuff, and who have, and it's their job to save people. And they actually did save a lot of people that night. But they were like, you know, like they had the shivers, and they were in shock, and they just couldn't believe what, like what just happened. But I remember talking to a couple of folks, thinking, sometimes I kind of feel, you know, I think I'm a little too sensitive to like do this sometimes. Like I feel like it's impacting me too much sometimes too. Like I'm talking to these folks and I just feel like, you know, like some of them just kind of needed to be hugged, you know, like they were shivering. They were dry heaving, some of them, because it was just a shock just kind of wearing on their bodies. I saw that a lot. Several people were just like, they would talk to me and they'd say, excuse me. And they would just start dry heaving because they were just in this state of shock still. And yeah, I mean, it definitely impacts me too. I kind of feel like I'm going through it with them, you know, in some sort of weird way, like I'm experiencing them, like I'm experiencing this with them.
Will you hug someone? You know, like, is that, I mean, it's obviously,
yeah, I have. Game. Yeah. I have, if it's something that they sort of initiate and that they feel comfortable with. Yeah, I definitely will. And I, you know, I've had people do that. There's a couple of times this time that I felt like hugging somebody because they needed a hug, but I didn't because I felt like it kind of crossed the line. And, you know, like there was one woman, I'll never forget her. She was at one of these shelters and she was just shivering. She was shivering from the shock, and she was shivering from just going through what she had been in. She had a horrific story. Like she actually, the sort of motel she was staying on just kind of collapsed around her and her boyfriend. And they had to crawl out of this rubble and run in the middle of this, you know, Cat 4 storm. They had to run to the shelter. But she was shivering, like she was so visibly affected by this. And she would walk up to her boyfriend and like lean in, and like all she wanted was somebody to put an arm around her, and the boyfriend wouldn't. You know, the boyfriend would just be like, "Well, just go sit over there if you want." He was sort of dealing with it in his own way, I guess.
Right.
And like wouldn't put an arm around her, and I felt like just hugging this woman and just kind of telling her, all right, stop shaking, it's gonna be okay. But you know, I didn't, you know, right. Partly because her boyfriend was there, partly because it does, you know, cross a sort of journalistic line. You try to be like an impartial sort of observer to all of it, you know, as much as you can.
You just walk up to people, like you see someone you want to talk to and it's in a high stress or a high trauma situation. Is it as simple as you walk up and introduce yourself? Is there a way you approach specifically?
It's really about as simple as that. I walk up. I always sort of like introduce myself first. I tell them like who I am and who I work for, and then I'm here to tell the story about this incident. And I was wondering if I could ask them a couple of really quick questions about it. And man, like most of them, I'd say like 85%, like usually say yes, you know, and they're just. Granted, they're in shock, but, you know, a lot of them want to tell their story too. You know, right. they kind of want it out there.
Right.
And like in the long run, it's, you know, it's definitely beneficial because the more people know about what's actually happening down there, the better it is, the more sort of resources start to show up down there. So like in the back of the mind, I do feel like it's serving a purpose. I think that I like my thinking is that I serve our readers first, right? Because they like want to know and sort of need to know about this. But I also serve the sort of community that I'm covering, because if I write enough about it, you know, resources start to show up there.
Right. Interesting. You did a Facebook Live video during the session. During the hurricane, and obviously that was something we were not thinking about in 1993.
Correct.
You know, we became journalists just to write. And I wonder how do you feel about sort of the integration of social media in reporting?
It's been an evolution. You know, like when I first started to integrate it, I sort of did it grudgingly, because I really did come up as a sort of pure journalist, just, you know, report and write. That's all I had to do. And if you wanted to take photos, you know, you basically filled out a photo request form, and somebody in the sort of photo department did that. And grudgingly, I had to more and more like post my articles on Facebook and Twitter, and more I had to post things, just updates. But now recently, especially after like these events, you know, I kind of realized that the phone is like where we live these days, right? The yeah. phone is where we is where we check up on people. The phone is where we read our articles, and people are reading a lot of my stories through their phones and through social media sites. So it's kind of where, and it was interesting because I like covered Harvey and I posted a lot of stuff and I was constantly posting stuff to my Facebook and Twitter feed. It's encouraged at our newspaper, obviously, but it's something that I've just come to like do almost like second nature now. But then Hurricane Irma, hit Florida yesterday. And today and yesterday, and I'm from South Florida. I'm from Miami, and so, and I wasn't sent to that, but I was like here in Austin, and for Irma, like, was a consumer, right? I was a news consumer, and I was reading every article that I could get my hands on. You know, I mean, I was just like absorbing every single piece of information that like came out of there. I had my brother down there. I have family down there, but I also found myself. Like really social media was where like I was getting a lot of the best information, you know? And so like as a consumer, like I could see how people consume news, consume information through social media sites. And it's these people who like put themselves way deep into the path of the storm down there that I was able to get that. And those guys live on social media. It's not like websites that I'm going to. Right. So now, yes. So now we've actually become a sort of multimedia journalists, right? So we're like, for Harvey, I was down there, and every chance I got, I would post an update to like Twitter or something that I saw, like an observation. I would snap photos with my iPhone and post that to like Twitter as well. I do Facebook Live things and like put that on Facebook. And then also, you know, I would talk to folks and like interview them and gather enough material to like later, like at my hotel, kind of sit down when I had a little bit of time and either write up a story or just send them feeds. And so the two things that I do during something like that, during a sort of disaster, is to send feeds constantly to our news desk back at headquarters right outside of Washington, D.C. And somebody there, like in the newsroom, pulls it all together, mine, and gets stuff from the weather guy, who works there in the headquarters, and pulls together like a sort of comprehensive story. Right. So I'm constantly sending feeds to them, and I'm also gathering stuff like for myself. And if I see an interesting enough angle or just an interesting enough profile, I kind of write it up as a separate story. So you're doing a lot of these different things that. Like all at the same time.
I remember when I was covering baseball at Sports Illustrated, and a Newsday reporter showed up for the first time with a camera, and the paper was asking him to do some recording or some photography and some video, and I was like, "To hell with that! I'm never mm-hmm. doing that. No way. What? That's not journalism." Now, yeah. Now it's like click.
Yeah, I mean. That's exactly how I felt too. You know, the first time I saw people taking that, like their own pictures and their video, I'm like, no, I'm never doing that. Right. I'm just a writer.
Click.
Never doing that.
Click.
And now, you know, it's now, I mean, now it's like, it's at least 50% of my job, if not like 60% to like, just try to get up. But now I sort of enjoy it. Right. Cause mm-hmm. I basically realize that, you know, that your true audience is like there on your phone. It's like on these social media sites. Give you a quick example. Like, you know, I do like stories around here, and I'll do like a Facebook Live from some event that's happening, from some story that I'm working on. And I may get like 50, 100 shares, like 200 shares is like really good. Mm-hmm. one of the ones that I did, it was like one of the earlier Facebook Lives that I did out of Corpus Christi, got 35,000 shares.
Wow.
So like, you know, like, so people are really hungry for like that type of stuff, and they share it, and that's how to get them like into our website too, which obviously is like the ultimate goal.
Right.
But I'm sort of more and more, I'm increasingly enjoying the sort of relationship that I have with my followers on Facebook and Twitter, and the sort of nuts and bolts of like putting information up there.
Yeah. I feel like if you could get some maybe sexy sweat rap videos on there as well.
Oh, just to forget about it.
I'm just saying.
Like 100,000 shares right there.
Yeah, it's all over.
That's a million shares.
We'd be blown up. one of your interesting tasks in your career is 2005, 2007, you were in Baghdad. Were you in Baghdad the entire time?
So, yeah, I was the Baghdad bureau chief for USA Today from 05 to 07. So a little bit over 2 years, like 2 years and 2 months or something. Hey, Jeff, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Just want to make sure you're there.
Yeah.
And so the sort of deal there when I was in Baghdad wasn't sort of continuous, right? Because back then, this is at the sort of beginning of the Iraq conflict, and nobody stayed there sort of continuously. It was just too much, like there was too much going on. It was like way too stressful. So the deal was that I would work in country for 6 weeks, and then they would give me 3 weeks off. So six on, three off.
Right.
And I did that throughout the course of like about 2 years.
So do you feel like are you more in the camp of every reporter should have the experience of reporting from a sort of war zone, or you have to be nut job crazy in hindsight to do that kind of thing?
I mean, it was such a great experience for like me personally that, I mean, if you had the opportunity and if there was a war going on, you know, and you were like at all curious or interested in what was happening there, I would say absolutely go for it, you know. And if you have a newspaper backing you, I think that's sort of key. I mean, I was lucky enough to like have sort of USA Today. I was like a full-time staffer for sort of USA Today, and I had the sort of resources and the support of like of a major sort of newspaper behind me. I wouldn't recommend it. You know, I met like so many people out there who were freelancers out there, and I just feel like freelancing in like sort of war zones are just so difficult because you just don't have the resources,
man.
And it's like hard to stay safe. Most of the people that I knew who like got in trouble out there, whether it was being kidnapped or you know, God forbid, or unfortunately killed, were usually freelancers, you know, who just didn't have, you know, enough money to hire like the right amount of guards or cars and so forth. But it's such a great experience, and I was just fascinated by it all, you know. Like the sort of scary part was definitely scary, and there were times that I wished there were like definitely times out there that I thought, okay, this was a really bad idea. I don't want to be a Baghdad.
Give an example, Rick. What would be an example of that?
So like the real threat out there was, all right, here's like a great example. So I did like a lot of embeds out there, right? And so like you did these sort of military embeds where you would embed with a military unit. And this is, I think this is when I was still with the Chicago Tribune, because I was with the Chicago Tribune first. The Tribune sent me out there for a temporary assignment in fall of 04. And that's when I first went to like Baghdad. And then later I left the Tribune, joined sort of USA Today. Mm-hmm. But when the Tribune sent me out there, I did an embed in south of Baghdad. I can't remember the name of the town, but it was either Latifia, which was really bad, or like Iskandaria, but it was sort of right around there. And I did an embed with a National Guard unit that had just recently arrived.
And the National Guard units were different from full-time sort of military personnel because they were not full-time military. They were National Guards guy who just, you know, like 3 weeks prior were lawyers and students and like professors and like, you know, like sort of regular people who just got called in and got sent to Iraq. And these guys had just arrived in Iraq and they just didn't know what they were doing. And they were, and so we got lost. So I like embedded with them and like we went out like on a sort of patrol, a big convoy of us in one of the worst parts of Iraq during one of the worst times. And we got lost and one of the cars got stuck. And meanwhile, like the insurgents knew we were there and started tossing mortars at us.
Whoa.
And like you could see like the mortars just getting closer and closer. And these guys were lost. They had a radio in to like figure out like how to get back to base. And I remember thinking, I'm going to get killed out here because of incompetence, not because of the insurgency, but because of incompetency. And that was definitely one of the times where I basically thought to myself, why are you out here? This is such a bad idea. Like you should not be out here. Like I wanted nothing to do with it anymore,
man.
But of course later, you know, then you go out with like a really competent unit and it's a very successful mission and you get a lot of really good stuff and you're able to tell the story, you know, a lot safer and it changes your mind again and you think, well, this is the greatest job, you know.
Right.
if you could like do this safely, it's an awesome job.
Right. You reminds me of running a marathon and at mile 13 you're like, I'm never doing this again. At mile 18, I'm never doing this again. You finish, you have your soup. When's the next one? When can I do the next one?
That's an excellent analogy. That's exactly how it is, actually. Because right. There were times that I was like, I am just not doing this anymore. I'm not like going back to that place. That place is insane. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I think I am going to do this again. Right. Because it was just fascinating. You know, you had this sort of front row seat of this incredible, dramatic time in U.S. history. And like you were able to be a witness to all of it, you know. I actually attended Saddam Hussein's trial, and you know, I got to see him from like 6 feet away, and it was just this kind of surreal moment that you're in this courtroom with this guy who's being tried on like war crimes, and it was just it's just a fascinating part of the world too, you know. Got to see a lot of Iraq, obviously, but also like a lot of Lebanon and Jordan. And this is a fascinating part of the world.
I have a theory, but I feel like you would know better than I do because you've covered much more of the world than I have by far. I generally think that the vast majority of people, like if you went to North Korea right now, the vast majority of people in North Korea just want to go about their days, eat their food, take care of their kids. You know, the vast majority of people in Iraq just want to go about their day. Like, people could actually get along, but we kind of screw it up. Or is that overly simplistic?
Oh, no, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's absolutely spot on. And I've seen that everywhere. You know, it's really unfortunate that it's always, you know, a very small sort of percentage of the larger population that does like all these atrocities, right?
Right.
Who either commit these atrocities or are ruling a country wrongly. But it's those guys that obviously get, you know, a lot of the coverage. And so people on the other side of the world see what's happening in that country, and they see the small population doing this, and they automatically assume, well, everybody's doing it in that country, right?
Right.
Because it's on TV. And I can tell you that the vast majority of like Iraqis out there, they basically want the same exact things we want. You know, they want peace. They want a little bit of money to like travel. They want their kids to go to decent schools. They want, you know, clean air and water. And they just kind of want to be left alone. And they were really, you know, the Iraqis that I met were like pretty amazing people. Even some of the ones who like completely disagreed with the U.S. invasion, the ones who were completely against it, who may even sided with the actual insurgency. Like I would meet them, I like go to their house, and they couldn't help but like sort of like invited me in and offered me tea and make me lunch, and then tell me, you know, that they completely disagree with everything that I actually stood for. but they were so hospitable, like they were so overtly sort of hospitable. And I think we absolutely could all sort of get along if we just came to understand that more, I guess.
Right. Let me throw a final one at you here. We, I hate to keep harking back, but we, you know, we did enter journalism in a much simpler time, and it was a no-brainer. Like going into journalism for me, going into journalism for you, it was a no-brainer. We knew if you worked hard, you're going to get a job somewhere. And I don't 100% know what to tell journalism students now. It doesn't seem like a guarantee. You know, it seems a lot harder.
Yeah.
Should, I don't know, you're some 18-year-old kid or you're some 21-year-old kid. Is it still worth it? Is it still viable?
Yeah, that's like a really tough one, right? Because the sort of journalism that they'll be getting into today is so different from the journalism that we got into. It's like unrecognizable, right? It's like, I think it's very different. But you know, I actually still really firmly believe that the basic tenets are still the same, right? Like they like things like learning how to analyze, getting information and broadcasting it out there, whether it's through, you know, social media sites or news site or newspaper or TV. Like those basic skills are like still very valued today, I think.
Right.
Regardless of what the actual medium is, and that those basic skills are going to continue to be valued. People are going to want to, people are always going to want, you know, news. They're always going to want to find a way to like read about what's happening in the world in some understandable format. And so, I mean, if I had to talk to an 18-year-old student, thankfully I haven't recently, but if I had to talk to an 18-year-old journalism student, I would tell them that, you know, that learn the basics and researching, being a good writer, and those type of basic skills are still going to be valued regardless of what the actual medium is. So learn those skills and then figure out which of the mediums you want to get into. Maybe it is a sort of multimedia reporter. Maybe it is somebody who wants to start a blog. Maybe it's somebody who just wants to go into a more sort of traditional news thing. But I think that there's always going to be an appetite for news gathering, and that's always going to be like a sort of valued skill.
Yeah, very well said. And can I announce officially, since we're both on here, that we are collaborating on Sexy Sweat, the biography?
Oh yeah, we are. Yeah, please announce that. Now all we need is for Sexy Sweat to like call us and contact us.
Yeah.
So Sexy Sweat, if you're out there,
Sweat, give us a ring. Call us Sweat.
Holler.
Rick, seriously, thank you so much for, it's like old home week. Thank you so much for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Enjoyed it.
I want to thank Rick Jervis, today's guest, for joining me on Two Writers Sling and Yang. One can follow Rick on Twitter at Mr. R. Jervis, and you can go to usatoday.com to read all this stuff. One can listen to Two Writers Sling and Yang on both iTunes and on bumpers.fm. Reviews are always appreciated. The music, again, is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks for joining me. And remember, keep writing.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.